Hello and welcome to the Gandhara, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Pakistan in Afghanistan. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. As if there wasn't enough trouble, law and order in Pakistan is troubled. Balochistan province is facing a new challenge, and that is coming from a feared militant group called ISIS. If the group and Pakistani security forces were to be believed, there is ISIS involvement behind a number of recent incidents, including the recent attack on Pakistani senators' convoy in Mastung district, kidnapping and later killing of Chinese workers from Quetta, etc. Further, in its latest report, Pakistani army claims that it destroyed an ISIS-operated base in mountains of Balochistan where dozens of heavy ammunition and explosives were found. These are few among increasing similar reports coming out of Balochistan in recent months. The question is, who are these people? What do they want in Balochistan? What is attracting them to the province? And more importantly, how serious of a threat is this? This is our topic for this edition of Gandhara Podcast. To discuss the subject, I'm joined by Kamran Bukhari, a Pakistani counter-extremism analyst who, among others, is the senior fellow and director of political affairs at the Global Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Afrasiab Khan Khattak is joining us from Pakistan, who's the former Pakistani senator from Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. Mohammed Ali Talpour, a Balochistani journalist, is joining us from Sindh province of Pakistan today. And Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, which looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan, is with us today from Prague. Gentlemen, welcome to the Gandhara.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. I think a reality check might be in order at the beginning of the discussion. After reaching out to many Pakistan experts of Western origin in America on this podcast, my impression was most of them are unaware or lacks sufficient knowledge on this development in Balochistan. So, Mr. Talpour, take us through, please. What have you been hearing from Balochistan lately in terms of ISIS's activities and penetration to the province?
I think this ISIS, well, you may give it any name. These things have been, the fundamentalists have been around for a very long time. I think they remain the same, but they change the name as if they're upgrading computers. And it's a threat not only to Balochistan, but most, I would say it's mostly a threat to this, because they are struggling for their national rights and this element of religion, which was introduced by the state with the malicious intent of thwarting the Baloch national struggle, as happened in 2013 earthquake in Awaran.
Okay, Abu Bakr, I want to take your input in this. So let's stick with the group who calls themselves ISIS in Balochistan. What do we know about this?
Well, I think what we know is mostly from the government. The government says that these are elements of, remnants of Lashkar-e-Jangvi, or Lashkar-e-Jangvi al-Alami. This is an offshoot of an extreme anti-Shia militant group that originated in the eastern province of Punjab and later on expanded to the province of Balochistan, where, as Mr. Talpour pointed out, there were suspicions and accusations from various quarters that some of these elements were involved in attacks on the Hazara minority, but also they were against the Baloch. And the Baloch nationalists, of course, are suspicious that this is, a new group being created to counter their campaign. In a separatist struggle for nearly a decade. So this group is basically local affiliates or local cells of Lashkar-e-Jangvi.
Afrasiab Khattak, what's your take in terms of the people who are involved in this, in terms of their ideology and ethnic background? Who are they?
I think I agree with my friends. I think it's the product and the result of cumulative impact created by the state policies for a long time. Unfortunately, the state has been tolerating sanctuaries for Afghans, Afghan Taliban, and then there are anti-Iran organizations, anti-Shia organizations. Basically, they are selfist Wahhabists, and they have been carrying on activities against Shias for a long time. It's for the first time in a decade that Pakistan army went for some action against them in Mastung, because Chinese were kidnapped and they raided that place for that. Otherwise, Shias, Hazaras have been killed for a long time, and the state has not taken any serious action.
Okay, Kamran, I'm hearing that they are, the group who calls themselves ISIS, are the same people who regrouped under new name. Is that your take?
Yes, I think that that is accurate, because ISIS is not going to export personnel, much less resources from Syria and Iraq or somewhere else to Pakistan. That's not possible. If you look at how ISIS has developed in various areas, whether it's Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, the Far East, now including the Philippines, these are local actors that go through, as Afrasay was saying, the different permutations and fragmentation and realignment. So I would sum it up as saying that, you know, these are people who were at one point with Al-Qaeda, were with the TTP, the Pakistani Taliban Rebel Alliance, or different factions of it, Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, as Abu Bakr mentioned, and there are other groups that are anti-Iranian, like Jundullah. I mean, this is a very fluid nexus. And what has happened is that after the Pakistani state went after the TTP, and these elements reorganized themselves, and at the same time, while the Pakistani state was going after the TTP, ISIS was rising. So I think what they did is that they just reorganized, regrouped, and relabeled themselves. And from ISIS's point of view, it may have given some material support, and you know, at some level, I don't think it's very significant, because it's difficult to transport or to provide that kind of support long distance across international borders. Then the Afghan Taliban have also seen and undergone a great deal of fragmentation. So I wouldn't be surprised if there are elements from the Afghan Taliban who have joined forces with ISIS. So this is a cross-border phenomenon that is now assuming a new label, a new form.
There are a number of things are emerging from this conversation. The first thing I was curious about is how are this new group, although all of you are in this belief that they are the members of the existing groups there, how they are getting along with the other insurgent groups in Balochistan, be it like in nationalist groups, be it an insurgent group, Abu Bakr?
Well, I think they are not there at odds with each other. I think you asked a very important question. We have to understand the specific context of Balochistan. Balochistan is Pakistan's largest province. 44% of Pakistani territory is Balochistan, but it's the least populated province. It is a resource-rich region which borders Iran and extend into Iran. In fact, the southeastern Iranian province of Sistan, Balochistan, is the largest province in Iran. So Balochistan has had these problems with Islamabad since the creation of Pakistan, because Baloch nationalists claimed that they were forcefully annexed by Pakistan. And this, the Baloch nationalist grievance, has resulted in the fourth major armed insurgency. So the Baloch insurgents have been mainly leftist and secular, and so are most of the Baloch political parties. So to counter Baloch nationalism, similar to what Pakistani policy or covert policies were to counter Afghan and nationalist claims and Afghan irredentist claims and Pashtun nationalists, ethno-nationalists in Pakistan, Pakistan promoted religious groups in Balochistan. Some of these were, according to local people, there were even some groups who engaged in actively targeting Baloch nationalists. So the Baloch nationalists are quite separate from these religious groups. I think the only similarity is that some of the members of this group might come from Baloch communities, particularly if there is a cell in Mastung, which is a Baloch region, then the chances are that most of the members of that cell are Baloch.
Mr. Talpur, maybe you would like to jump in here. So how Baloch nationalist groups are responding to the group who calls themselves ISIS?
The Baloch group have had armed confrontation with these groups. They have been fighting between them. They have resisted them because I think they are diametrically opposed to each other. These fundamentalist groups have been attacking Zigris. They have been attacking different people of different faith. And the Baloch groups, especially in Awaran and in areas of Makran, the Baloch groups have targeted them. They have been fighting between them, and they are absolutely enemies of each other. and the Baloch understand that these groups are being used to subvert their national struggle as by creating disharmony between the Baloch, for example, work they do to attack those elements, secular elements that are seen as a threat to the state or are seen as supporting the national struggle.
Mr. Thapur, you said that the Baloch nationalists are engaged with them in a number of areas in Balochistan. So it means this group has already expanded to beyond Quetta, beyond Mastung, the center of the recent incidents.
Yes, as I said, this in Turbat and in certain areas of Makran, these elements attacked schools, especially which were giving English education or the girls' school. It's not only Mastung. These groups, they were sponsored. Probably we still be having some sort of covert support of the state. There were groups of responsible for the Tutak mass graves, which were found near Kalat. It's been a long story. It's been going on, and I think it's now genie is out of their hand, and it started to strike at them as well.
Okay, Mr. Khatak, we know it from Afghanistan that they are not in good terms with the Taliban there, at least in southern Afghanistan. So what is the nature of their relationship with the Taliban in Balochistan?
You see, as my friends were saying, unfortunately, Pakistani state policies have really encouraged this religious extremism, because in post-Ziaul-Haq Pakistan, this has been sort of a so-called nation-building policy for Pakistani ruling elites. They think that by encouraging religious extremism, they can weaken ethnic and historical and cultural identity. If not totally liquidate them, they can weaken them. It's sort of a method for deconstructing historical identity. So unfortunately, they have been promoted. For example, Pashtun nationalists have also been victim of Taliban attacks. My party has lost more than 800 political activists, members who were killed by Taliban in Pakistan. And even in Afghanistan, they kill nationalist Afghans, nationalist Pashtuns, Tajiks, and Azaz, and everybody. So I think basically, these people are not at friendly relations with nationalists of any kind, because their ideology is basically Wahhabism and Salafism.
But what about their relationship with the Taliban in Balochistan?
You see, Taliban have some problems with IS in Afghanistan. I don't know about, because in Balochistan there is no report about any fight between Taliban and IS. They have coexisted and there is no contradiction.
Abu Bakr, your take on this?
Well, I think in Balochistan, Pakistani province of Balochistan, the Afghan Taliban are more basically sheltering there. They are not actively participating in local politics. And we have to also recognize the fact that the Pakistani province of Balochistan is very diverse. The 10 northern districts of Balochistan are Pashtun populated, and the rest of the 22 or so districts are Baloch populated. So this IS has emerged in Baloch regions, and not in Pashtun regions. And within Pashtun regions, the Afghan Taliban, unlike the Pakistani Taliban or TTP, has been very quiet, and they've been laying low. They use Balochistan, of course, as a resting place and a sanctuary and a hideout or a safe haven. But they are not very active in terms of locally targeting people. There have been some incidents of Afghan Taliban going after some Afghan tribesmen, particularly people close to the Kandahar police chief, General Abdul Razik, who the Taliban consider as their enemy number one. And General Razik's people have been accused of engaged in targeted assassination of Afghan Taliban figures in Balochistan's capital, Quetta. So we have to make this distinction. And I would also like to make another distinction. I think in Afghanistan, most of the the Taliban core is basically from Kandahar, while the Islamic State or Islamic State Khorasan province is mostly the main power mainly comes from Pakistan. One of its founding leader, Hafiz Saeed, who was killed this year in eastern Afghan province of Nangarhar, was from Aurangzeb in Pakistan. In Balochistan context, the IS is very different. And you also have to factor in Iran here.
obviously.
Because some of the Baluch factions, unlike in Pakistan, the Baluch factions, militant factions in Iran were mostly religiously inspired. Jandullah's leader, Abdul Malik Righi, went to a madrasa in Karachi, a Sunni Diobandi madrasa. Groups such as Jandullah and later on, there was another group. They have employed Diobandi extremism to fight against Iran's Shia clerical regime. Because as a Sunni minority in Iran, the Baluch also feel that they are discriminated against and exploited because they are a Sunni minority in an overwhelmingly Shia country ruled by a Shia clerical regime.
Kamran, I want to take your point, and a very interesting point Abu Bakr raised earlier. The fact that IS has emerged in Baluch region, what does it tell you?
I mean, clearly they have assets on the ground. I mean, anytime a group emerges in a specific geopolitical piece of real estate or a specific geographic region, it is because not that they want to be there, it's because they have the resources to be there. And I suspect that Balochistan, given what my colleagues have just talked about in terms of, you know, the vastness of the area, the weak writ of the Pakistani state, the availability of different factions of jihadists and Islamist militants, and of course, when you have large ungoverned spaces, I mean, this is sort of the type of area in which groups like that can mushroom, and ISIS is able to exploit these circumstances. I think that that is why Balochistan is seeing this sort of uptick in terms of an ISIS presence. Balochistan also, you know, allows for ISIS to have at least striking capability into Iran. I suspect, and we don't have any evidence, but I suspect that ISIS is somehow trying to take over what used to be Jundullah of Abdul Malik Righi, and then became Jaish al-Adl. And I think that that network is also being at least eyed or trying to be taken over by ISIS so that they have capability and reach inside Iran. We recently saw the attack in Tehran, although that came from Kurdish elements in Iran. But nonetheless, this is a capability that ISIS would like to have. Balochistan also provides for proximity to the Afghan south. One of my colleagues just recently mentioned that ISIS is in Afghanistan, is in the eastern areas, which is in contrast with the Afghan Taliban core turf in the south, in Kandahar, Helmand, Uruzgan, and that vicinity. So it provides for a very large area in which to operate. You can strike in Afghanistan, link up with assets in eastern Afghanistan. You can operate in Pakistan. It threatens the Chinese presence there, especially with CPEC and all of that. The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor provides for striking capability into Iran. So I think it's a strategic location, as well as it has the necessary resources that ISIS can build upon.
So are we witnessing radicalization of at least part of the Baluch society, which we know them like as a very secular tribe in that part of the world?
I think it has been happening for a long time. The fact that there is a Jundullah and then Jaish al-Adl, and then we've had attacks upon the Shia Hazara in the past. Lashkar-e-Jangvi is in there. Of course, this is a diverse area. There are different types of Baloch tribes. There is the Pashtun corridor in the northwest of the province, near Quetta, all the way to South Waziristan in Fatah. But if you look at the way the whole situation is emerging, this is an area where, yes, at one point the tribes were secular, but given the nexus between tribal sensibilities and religious conservatism and extremism, it's easy to understand how religious conservatism could spread. And then, of course, Faseb earlier said that, you know, there is this nation building that's been going on, and I really don't think that Balochistan was immune from it. The so-called Islamization of Pakistan, beginning from Zia-ul-Haq all the way to, the present. I have a hard time believing that Balochistan was somehow immune to this.
Okay, so what does this situation mean to the province of Balochistan and its existing problems? Is this a local problem? And most importantly, where we are heading with this going forward? We will continue the conversation discussing this and many other questions shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Gandhara podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Majlis podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Central Asia from local perspective. and the podcast is published every week, most probably Saturdays, on Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on Gandhara, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's podcast on Pakistan and Afghanistan. We are discussing ISIS in Balochistan of Pakistan. Joining me in the discussion are Kamran Bukhari, a Pakistani counter-extremism analyst who is the director of political affairs and a senior fellow at the Global Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Afrasiab Khan Khattak, former Pakistani senator from Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, Muhammad Ali Talpur, a Balochistani journalist, and Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, are joining me in the discussion. And I'm Mohammed Tahir here in Washington, D.C. To start with you, Kamran Bukhari, given the details that we got so far, how dangerous do you think is this group become? And what we know about their capacity and size?
I don't think anyone has a good handle on the true capacity of the Islamist extremist network or nexus within Balochistan province in Pakistan. If anyone knows, then it has to be the Pakistani authorities, particularly the intelligence service. They have the best window into this, and I doubt that they will share the information. But having said that, one of the things that we have to bear in mind is the situation in Balochistan is going from bad to worse. We have already talked about, and my colleagues have spent a great deal of time explaining, how Balochistan had a ethno-nationalist separatist tendency, and going back to the founding of Pakistan, that issue was never completely pacified. It resurfaced over the decades, to a large extent, that sentiment, movement, that tendency still exists, albeit it is weakened now. Now, what is replacing it is this tendency of this Taliban phenomenon, this ISIS, this Al Qaeda, jihadi phenomenon, and so in many ways, the integration, the desired integration of Islamabad for Balochistan is getting even more complicated. Khattak Saab mentioned earlier that there was the nation-building thing around that Zia-ul-Haq wanted to do, and the establishment and the Pakistani state did in the 70s, sort of, counter not just Baloch nationalism. It was done to counter Sindhi nationalism and Pakhtun nationalism and forge, if you will, a national doctrine or at least a national ideology around religion. Now, what that has done is that has allowed for these actors, because no state, whether, you can go to the Arab world, you can go to the Far East, and we see Uzbekistan doing this right now, is that any state that has used religion as a means of national cohesion, it has really blown up in their face. We've seen this in Yemen. We're seeing it in Saudi Arabia. The only one exception is Iran right now, because that state, and even there, the situation is deteriorating. But nonetheless, when you try to fight ethno-nationalism with religion, you create a bigger problem than before. And this is exactly what's happening in Balochistan. And the fact that the writ of the Pakistani state remains weak, what we are now facing in Balochistan is, and this is a spillover of Afghanistan, a spillover of the situation in Sistanva, Balochistan in Iran as well, is that the national project that Islamabad wants to implement is not going to happen, because you have a new problem that is undermining or making the original problem worse.
Oh, that's interesting. Afrasiab Khan Khattak, Kamran was talking about the spillover of problems from regions to Balochistan. Balochistan, as we discussed in the first half of the discussion, in itself is in the midst of lots of many problems. And again, the location also very strategic. In the first half of the discussion, we also talked about the possible connection of this new development to sort of tensions that we are having in the region. You had a story on this recently. Expand on that, Mr. Khattak.
I think the recent confrontation that has risen in the Middle East between Saudi Arabia, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and Islamic Republic of Iran does not bode well for Balochistan, because Balochistan is not far away from the volcano that has started erupting in the Middle East. When Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia said that he wouldn't wait for Iranians to bring this war into Saudi Arabia, he would like to take it into Iran. I mean, when important government people use this language, it's pretty clear that in Iran, fault lines that they can look for are ethnic and sectarian. Sectarian is Sunni-Shia divide. Iran is a predominantly Shia country, which is being ruled ruled by theocracy. Shia clergy is ruling it. And then there are non-Persian ethnic groups like Arabs, Kurds, Baloch, Turkmens, Azeris, etc. So I think in some cases these fault lines overlap because some of the ethnic minorities are Sunni while the ruling clergy is Shia. So both these things can be used simultaneously. And Balochistan, of course, has a history in the past. So I think Balochistan was being eyed by both sides. Saudi Arabia would pour more money into these Wahhabi groups, which were mentioned by my friends and myself. So that is really a very dangerous thing because Balochistan is already unstable. But induction of new players like Saudi Arabia, like United Arab Emirates, investing into these existing organizations and strengthening them, and then Iran trying to counter them, that doesn't augur well for the stability of Balochistan.
Okay, Abu Bakr, what I hear from Afrasiab Khan Khatak is that Balochistan is turning to the center of regional tension, hostility. Is it how you read this?
Well, I think I agree with him, and I think, unfortunately, new players are being added into this mix. I think that what Pakistan has been doing is try to do away with the nationalist insurgency. First of all, I mean, the insurgency in Balochistan originally was kind of more of an autonomy-seeking type. The Baloch were, I think, initially in the early 2000s, were very easily willing to be happy with some kind of more provincial autonomy and that kind of stuff. But later on, when the Pakistani cracked down against them in a way harshened, and it prompted them to become a separatist movement. So what I see is that, I mean, in terms of Pakistani policy, that some of these tactics might work for a while, but they create and prompt even bigger strategic problems. So we should not forget that in Balochistan is the linchpin of these Chinese investment, collectively called the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which aims to connect the Gulf to Western China. Again, a restive region, Xinjiang, a predominantly Muslim province, which is own separatist problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take Mr. Talpur's point on this. So at least two guests are saying that emergence of ISIS, in part at least, might has to do with the regional tension. How people in Balochistan read this?
There's one thing friends have been mentioning, that it's since Zia that this Islam thing has started. For Baloch, they were annexed on the excuse that because Balochistan on 27th March 1948, they were annexed because they said that being Muslims, they should be part of Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And then said that if it is necessary for being Muslim and joining Pakistan, then why are all the countries Muslims which are not part of Pakistan?
Mr. Talpur, do you see the emergence of IS has any connection to Iran and Saudi tension?
I think it will be used by them, both of them. Hmm. And moreover, I think it's the Baloch nationalists who are under threat at this particular time of history, because on one side, there's a Chinese involvement. The Chinese want Gwadar to be very, that is, they want a fence around it. They want residency passes for Gwadar residents on one hand, and then all the way they have to protect it. The special army units have been created to defend CPEC. With this new problem of IS, I think, which naturally any element, there's a monopoly of force is very distributed. It's not only the state which has the monopoly of force over there. There are so many groups, there are so many elements over there, and especially with being supported by anybody who wants instability in Iran will support those elements which will are a threat to Iran. So I feel that it's the Baloch who is going to suffer. It's the Baloch who is suffering. They would be swamped in this new game that is being played between the religious elements and the different states in the region.
Mm-hmm. If Balochistan is turning to a battlefield for the region, it's not only Baloch, but Pakistan will suffer from this. From that point of view, Kamran, what the Pakistani authorities doing about this?
Well, it's not what they want to do, it's what they can do. I mean, I'm sure from an intent point of view, the Pakistani authorities do not want to see this trend move forward. I mean, this is not in their interest. But when you just look at it from an intent point of view, that's as far as we're going to get. But the real issue is, what can they do? And that we can see from, you know, the numerous attacks that have taken place in the province over the years. And there doesn't seem to be any cessation in that trend, or at least a subsiding of that trend. And that's because I think the Pakistanis are stretched very thin. They have too much on their plate. There is the issue with India and the tensions there. There is the issue with the western border with Afghanistan, you know, the tribal areas as well as the KPK. There are other issues inside urban Pakistan. We can go even speak about Punjab and places like Karachi and interior Sindh now. And so I think that they're, the bandwidth is stretched, and there's not much that they can do. And then there's, of course, the effort to get the CPEC running. I think that the problem has magnified to a point where it's beyond Pakistani capability alone. And then, of course, the ungoverned spaces are so vast that it's very easy for people who have other interests, like Iranian intelligence, Saudi intelligence, to come in and operate, even if it is, you know, a few individuals, and work with local actors to pursue their goals. So I think that the first order of business here for the Pakistanis would be to, you know, really focus to the extent that they can. This is an issue of constraint. You know, you only have so many forces, you only have so many resources, financial and otherwise coercive, to be able to put to this problem. And I think that there is sort of this balancing act. Okay, so do we go after the jihadist elements, or are they a bigger threat, or do we go after the nationalist elements, are they a bigger threat? And because the Pakistani state is so vast, I think that there is a huge debate within the Pakistani state as to which is the priority. I think that it'll be a while before the Pakistanis really are able to divert attention. And so I think that, unfortunately, we're going to see the situation deteriorate in at least in the short term.
Okay. Unfortunately, we have to conclude the discussion with this final note. And as Kamran, you said that this tension might be already beyond Pakistan's control, and the region is becoming increasingly violent. So in this situation, what the future holds for Balochistan going forward? Let's start with you, Abu Bakr.
Well, I think in the immediate future, definitely there is more instability. But I think Pakistani state, Pakistani elites can still do a lot to turn the situation around. Mm-hmm. I'll give you one example. In 2015, we reported on this initiative by former Balochistan chief minister, and he was part of the current ruling coalition, Dr. Abdul Malik Baloch. He approached Bahram Dalbukhti, one of the main separatist leader in exile in Switzerland. And Bahram Dalbukhti basically agreed to return to Pakistan and to negotiations. And I think there was a real possibility of a major breakthrough in the conflict. But, I mean, nobody chased that opportunity, unfortunately. So I think one of the key things that needs to happen is that, apart from the real security calculus that people are so obsessed with these days, Pakistani elites, particularly Pakistan's powerful military establishment, needs to look into the political toolbox and allow the political class, the politicians, the civilian government, to and encourage it to kind of approach the Baloch separatists. But I don't think that Pakistan will have any future by becoming a jihadist state, because we have seen in many cases with many groups, from Lashkar-e-Jangvi to TTP, that if you allow these people, they are ultimately not going to listen to you. They're going to impose their worldview, their vision, and their ideology through the barrel of the gun. And that's a future that I think most Pakistanis are definitely not ready to live with.
Okay. Afrasab Khan Khatak, briefly, the question is, what does this increasing security situation means for Balochistan, and what the Pakistani authorities can do about it?
Well, it's really baffling to see that Pakistani security czars have not been able to comprehend the situation. Because as my friends were saying, I mean, the situation is going to deteriorate.
So what they should do going forward?
For example, they should have clear break with the past policies of patronizing non-state actors, allowing religious schools, brainwashing centers, factories that are producing terrorists and extremists. Those factories have to be dismantled and closed, and state patronage has to stop from these organizations. Pakistan has got 61 banned organizations. Most of them are working under new names. They are publicly active. They should be disallowed. I mean, Pakistan can have a break from the policies, but unfortunately, so far, it's not visible. And God forbid, if situation deteriorates, I mean, this Pakistan-China corridor is supposed to create, build a connection between Western China and Baluchistan for trade. But unfortunately, if there is instability, this route can, of course, come under threat. Construction can come under threat. And this ideology can travel on this route also. So it can be dangerous for Chinese Xinjiang. And Chinese, I don't think Chinese will be prepared to put up with that. Then again, Iran, Saudi Arabia thing, in the past, we have seen it in polarized Pakistan. You see, the Shia-Sunni divide. Pakistan has substantial Shia minority. In the past, Saudi Arabia and Iran have been fighting proxy wars on Pakistani soil. This history can be repeated. It can further destabilize Pakistan. And look at this Wahhabi Salafi belt being developed in Baluchistan. Can link up with this Taliban thing in northern Pakistan and then Wahhabi Salafi networks in Punjab. This is on the one hand, then Iran, Iraq, and parts of other Middle Eastern parts of Shia population confronting each other. These are very dangerous prospects. I'd say Pakistani government should revisit its policies. Taliban project should be winded up, and these groups should be stopped from activities, public activities, the way they are operating. So I think Pakistan has a lot to do, but unfortunately so far, political will to do that is not visible. Pakistani government is in a survival mode. There's confrontation between different state institutions, and Nawaz Sharif's government doesn't seem to be capable of handling the situation because it is already getting destabilized by the forces from within the state that are not comfortable with it.
Yeah. Let's take shortly Mr. Talpur's point in this. In this situation, what a Baluch person wants from the Pakistani authorities do going forward? Briefly, please.
I think to get a secular Baluchistan, it would be essential, it is necessary that the Baluch be given the rights they are demanding. It's the only way out of this situation. The Pakistani state will be always unable to control them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Kamran, final point. So what is way out from this?
I think the Pakistanis have to solve the Baloch nationalist problem, the separatist problem. They have to align themselves and bring the separatist into the mainstream. And then that could be used as leverage to counter the jihadis and the Islamist militants.
Okay. Thank you very much for your insightful comments. Kamran Bukhari, Pakistani counter-extremism analyst, senior fellow and director of political affairs at the Global Policy Center in Washington, D.C., Also, big thanks goes to Afrasiab Khan Khatak, former Pakistani senator from Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, Muhammad Ali Talpur, Balochistani journalist, Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Freedom for Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, for your time and thoughts in today's discussion.